This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we remember our friend, colleague, and comrade, attorney Len Wineglass.
It's the one-year anniversary of Len's death. We miss Len as friends and as one of the most amazing people's lawyers in the United States. Today we will hear an interview with Len by Miguelito Alvarez from Cuban Television.
We'll speak with publisher Colin Robinson, the man who pulled together the wonderful book Occupying Wall Street, the inside story of an action that changed America.
This book brings you right into the heart of Occupy Wall Street. It's as if you were there, not just before it started, but every day of the two-month occupation of Liberty Square.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I want to ask you about Bradley Manning. I know you've been down in Fort Meade observing the proceedings, the legal proceedings that the military is using against him. Give us an update on that.
Last week, I again went to some of the hearings regarding Bradley Manning. There's been no trial scheduled yet. They're thinking of a trial in August. I think it'll much more likely be in the fall. As our listeners know, Bradley Manning has been indicted on 22 charges or charged in the military on 22 charges, including aiding with the enemy. I did my usual trying to get to Fort Meade, but of course it was scheduled for 9 a.m. on Thursday. I had to get on a train that night, then get a car, then get to Fort Meade. And when you get to Fort Meade, of course, they practically tear your car apart looking for who knows what, explosives or something else. You get in, they then make you wait about an hour before you go through a trailer where you go through one of those metal detectors. You're not allowed to bring into the courtroom any cell phones, any way of communicating other than a pencil and a paper. The courtroom is small. There's only about 20 of us in the courtroom. The media is in a separate media room where they can have their computers, nothing with the internet, but they can at least use a computer. So in any case, I went to Bradley Manning's hearing. It was Thursday and Friday. It was quite extraordinary. Michael and I have always talked about the expression, military justice is to justice as military music is to music. Well, it's even worse than that. I mean, this was ridiculous. I mean, that they are trying the most probably well-known case of in the country on aiding the enemy, or really what amounts to, according to the government, a sort of espionage case, in this little two-bit courtroom with military prosecutors that the defense counsel runs circles around. David Coombs is actually doing a very good job. Is amazing. I'll just relate a couple of the stories. The first thing that happens is the defense counsel asks for what's called a bill of particulars in criminal cases. That's, please tell the defense counsel more about the charges you have against my client, Bradley Manning. Give a few specifications. And the first one he asked about is, what did he mean by aiding the enemy? He says to the prosecutor, and of course it's all done in paper, but he says it in court as well. And the prosecutor then says, well, aiding the enemy. The enemy is Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula. Well, that just sounds ridiculous. Bradley Manning, who is supposedly, allegedly uploaded various documents regarding killing of Reuters journalists, 15,000 Iraqi civilians who were killed, which the U.S. hadn't recorded, many, many war crimes like that, is accused somehow of aiding the enemy of Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda on the peninsula. Well, you think, what is it? Is it because it embarrassed the United States that we're aiding them? What is going on here? So then the defense counsel continues, well, aiding Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda on the peninsula, how did he aid them? And then the prosecutor gives, like, you know, you got to say one of the shallowest, stupidest answers you want to hear. Well, he aided them by uploading the documents onto the WikiLeaks website. I mean, it's not the trial yet, so the defense counsel just says, okay, and we move on from there. But you're sitting there in the audience saying, this is crazy. This 22-year-old, now 24-year-old kid is supposedly aided Al-Qaeda by giving documents about war crimes to WikiLeaks. Nonsensical. It'll never stand up. Most commentators think that charge in particular, which is the most serious charge, it's life imprisonment, death penalty possibly. Prosecutors said they won't ask for death penalty, but life in prison, and I think the judge could even give the death penalty, that charge I don't think will hold up. But the interesting part that then happens next, 3 weeks ago when I was at the court, the prosecutor complains that he is not getting any of the emails sent by defense counsel or by the judge. And those are obviously important emails. The defense counsel is responding to motions and arguments, sending briefs. The court is sending decisions and scheduling orders, etc. And the prosecutor 3 weeks ago says, well, I haven't gotten anything, so I can't respond to those. Sounds pretty bad, fishy. But then the prosecutor says, we will fix it in 3 weeks from now. And that's when I was there last week. And the prosecutor gets up and says, well, up until March 10th, we didn't figure it out. Just a few days before I'm there for the Bradley Manning hearing. And we found it out. Here's the answer. Many of the emails from the court and the defense counsel are going to the prosecutor, but they're going into the spam section of the prosecutor's computer. They're being filtered out as spam. Let me just say, this is the most important single military courts martial case they've had probably in the last 50 years, maybe 100 years. And the emails from the court and the defense counsel are going into the spam of the prosecutor. I mean, this is just Mickey Mouse or worse. So they said, what we're doing now, the prosecutor says, is because they're going into spam, every morning at 10 a.m., I'm checking my spam filter to see what emails have come in. So I'm sitting there in the audience saying, why are they checking their spam filter? Why aren't they just fixing the problem? And then half an hour later, the defense counsel gets up, and in speaking about many issues, he addresses why the emails haven't gone to the prosecutor. And he says they didn't go to the prosecutor because any email with the word WikiLeaks in it anywhere, subject matter, in the substance, anywhere in an email from the defense counsel or the court that says WikiLeaks is automatically spammed by the prosecutor's filter on his computer, so he doesn't see them. Now you say to yourself, wait a second, this entire case is about Bradley Manning allegedly uploading documents to WikiLeaks, yet the prosecutor or the government computers are using that as spam? This is ridiculous. This is not a trial. This is just a charade. And then you realize, taking another step back, is most likely every government computer in the United States and in the world spams anything to do with WikiLeaks, because, of course, the fact that many of our listeners out there, you and I, Michael, the New York Times, and everybody else in the world looks at WikiLeaks documents, government still considers them to be stolen documents, still classified, and no one in the government should ever be allowed to see them. So here they go. They're doing this entire investigation of WikiLeaks, etc., and everything is treated as spam. So that's just one of the oddities of what they're calling a trial, etc. Two other points, and we'll be talking about this as I continue to monitor that trial for WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. The Center for Constitutional Rights represents them, both Julian and WikiLeaks, for purposes of monitoring the Bradley Manning case. Two other interesting things came out. One is the access to documents. Now, this is supposedly a public trial. By law, it's a public trial. The First Amendment requires it to be a public trial, that you and I and the press and spectators are all allowed to go in the courtroom and watch the trial, unless there's some section that's classified. And normally in a trial, as you know, Michael, being a lawyer, that when you file papers, they go into a court docket, and you can get access to those papers, whether they be motions or briefs or whatever you file. And of course, that's what happens in this case, at least the first part. You file papers, or the prosecutor files papers, defense counsel files papers, decisions are made. But nobody has access to those papers except for the counsel. I can't get those papers as a lawyer. The press can't get those papers. No one can see the motions or anything else. And so you're sitting in the courtroom and they're arguing about various documents that have been filed, and you feel like you're going in completely blind. You don't understand half of what's going on because you can't read the papers. It's like being in that Plato's cave where you only see the shadows on the wall and not the actual substance. So we've been making an effort over the last 2 weeks to figure out how do we get these papers. And we know that ultimately we'll get them. Ultimately, they're going to have a system set up with a clerk where they give press and WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and the public access to public motions that have been filed. But we're probably going to have to wind up going to federal court to get them. I mean, it's horrendous. I mean, this is like ridiculous.
It's like state secrets.
It's like state secrets, except they haven't claimed state secrets. They claim state secrets for certain things, and that I understand, but that they put into another file. These are all public documents. There's no argument. Even the most recent one that happened, they entered a agreement around pretrial publicity. The defense counsel, as well as the prosecutor and the judge, signed an order. Not an agreement, but after an argument that she signed an order. This is an important issue. What is going to be allowed to be said by the various parties to this case? And you would think the public and the press would have some interest in that. As of today, when I'm recording this show a week after the hearing, we have not seen what that pretrial publicity order says. None of it was argued in public. It was argued in a special proceeding called an 802. The 802 proceeding, which is what allows the off-the-record discussion, is only supposed to be used for scheduling it, but the judge is using it now for substantive arguments. So all the arguments are taking place in secret. They come back and report to us that there's been a pretrial publicity order entered. We don't see it. The press doesn't see it. Nobody sees it. So here you again have a guy accused of uploading all of these war crime secrets being essentially tried in secret. If you have to say something about the case that's significant, the one thing you would say is we have a secret trial going on right now in which the press and the public and lawyers for WikiLeaks and Julian Assange are not getting access. Hopefully we'll be able to change that, but the stubbornness, the backwardness, the antediluvian nature of the entire military justice system, if you want to call it that, is astounding.
It seems to me Bradley Manning is nothing but a whistleblower, which is something we should encourage, and that the enemy that he's accused of aiding is us, that the public is the enemy. The problem for the government is that the public is getting informed about what's being done in Iraq, criminal activity that's been being done, and they don't want the public to know about it. And we're being treated as the enemy.
It's completely right, Michael. I mean, that's right. He is a whistleblower, Bradley Manning. He's a hero and should be a hero to everybody in this country who cares about war crimes. And he's not being treated as such, but he should be. And it is true that what I think the government fears in this case and in other whistleblower cases is revealing the truth of their war crimes to the American people. Michael Smith, last week we marked a very sad anniversary, the one-year anniversary of Lenny Wineglass's death. Of course, Lenny was one of the great U.S. civil rights, human rights lawyers, radical lawyers, Chicago 8, etc. He was a close friend of mine and of particularly yours, Michael. And I know it hit us all very, very hard. In fact, when I look back at one of the things that the center and I'm still working on, we're still part of the counsel team for WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. And that happened only because of Lenny. A little over a year ago, a year and 3 months ago, I went to London with Lenny to visit with Julian Assange and spent an entire day with him. And of course, Julian was, as would almost anybody, was very impressed with Lenny's skills, his abilities. And we miss him terribly on that case. I mean, I just feel like helpless on it in a certain way. But that's why I'm involved even with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, because Lenny was interested in working on that case.
Well, I had written a short piece on Len, and I want to read the last part of it. Len died in the evening of March 23, 2011, as spring was approaching in New York. He had plans to celebrate Passover in April, as usual, with his family in New Jersey. He knew quite a lot about Passover, led his family's observance at the Seder every year, and he kept up with a file on the holiday. He liked the idea that the Jews had the chutzpah to conflate their own flight from slavery with spring and the liberation of nature. He had plans to tend his fruit trees on the side of the hill next to his Catskill cabin. He would have put in a vegetable garden near his 3-block-long driveway, which frequently washed out and which he repaired with Sisyphean regularity. He would have set out birdseed on the cabin's porch rail, where he would sit in a lounge chair on a platform and watch the songbirds feed. He loved being out on that porch high up on a hill, particularly at the day's end, seeing the sun go down over the Rondout Reservoir, which supplied some of the drinking water to New York City. Back in 1976, he told a student reporter for the UCLA Daily Bruin that leading a committed life was satisfying, fulfilling, and that was what made him happy. Len was a wonderful storyteller. The times we spent together are treasured. He will be remembered by me as a good, generous, and loyal friend, a gentle and kind person. Politically, as a great persuasive speaker, an acute analyst of the political scene, and a far-seeing visionary. Professionally, Len will live on as one of the great lawyers of his time, joining the legal pantheon of leading 20th century advocates for justice, along with Clarence Darrow, Leonard Boudin, Arthur Conoy, Ernest Goodman, and William Kunstler. "Lenny cannot be replaced," wrote his friend Sandra Levinson. "There are no words for the loss we all feel. Do something brave. Put yourself out there for someone. Fight for someone's dignity. Do something to honor this courageous, just man." Leonard Wineglass, presente. And now we're going to an interview that he did in 2004 with Miguel Alvarez for Cuban television.
It began shortly after I completed my studies at law school, finished my military service, and in the early 60s, I moved into the city of Newark, New Jersey, which then had an organizing project by the Students for Democratic Society, which came to the city of Newark to organize in the African American community. I became a lawyer for the group, and then for activists within the community. In 1967, a rebellion occurred in the city of Newark. The National Guard was called in. The city was occupied. 27 people were killed. And I was involved in the legal work resulting from that activity. Then a young African-American man named Ken Gibson announced he would run for the mayor of Newark. He ran, I represented him, and he became the first African-American mayor of the city of Newark. So that's how it all began. Relationship of the United States and Vietnam going back over 40 years. Actually, in 1971. In that case, which became a major trial, almost 6 months in length, with over 100 witnesses, the Pentagon had commissioned a study of that history, and 46 volumes were compiled reflecting that 40-year history. Every page of that encyclopedic work was stamped top secret, and only 5 copies were made, one for the president.
For the president of the United States?
Yes. Mm-hmm. One for the Congress, one for the Pentagon, one for the State Department, and one was given to a consulting study organization called the RAND Corporation. These documents were so tightly held that a member of Congress could only read them if accompanied by 2 Marines in the basement of the Capitol building. But one of the advisors and experts to the RAND Corporation was a man named Daniel Ellsberg. And when he read these 46 volumes, and the war was ongoing, the casualties on both sides were mounting, that he would release these volumes to the New York Times. And he did so. And the New York Times began to publish. And for the first time in history, the President of the United States ordered that these newspapers be halted. And the case went to the Supreme Court of the United States. And the Supreme Court approved the continued publication. But the FBI arrested Dan Ellsberg, and he faced very serious charges, 99 years in prison, for giving this study to the New York Times. And he had a co-defendant who assisted him in all of this, also worked at RAND, named Tony Russo. And I became the chief counsel for Tony Russo. And the trial was on the question of whether Ellsberg did the right thing or the wrong thing in violating U.S. laws in turning over this study. And the national attention was focused on this case. And generals testified, admirals testified, presidential advisors testified, Noam Chomsky testified, Howard Zinn testified, Robert Scheer, Tom Hayden, the intellectual left, and the Pentagon was testifying essentially against each other. And just before the case was submitted for a decision to 12 members of the community who were the jury, it was dramatically revealed that the White House had ordered a group who operated from the White House to break into the offices of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist in Los Angeles to obtain information from the psychiatrist's files to be used against Dan Ellsberg in the trial.
Could you tell me why somebody like Howard Zinn, who is an historian, was a witness at this trial?
Yes, Howard's testimony was very interesting. I put him on the stand because we wanted to demonstrate the nature of this history, that it should not have been considered top secret information. And so when Howard took the stand, I showed him one book of the 46 volumes, and I asked him to open to a page. And I asked him, what is on the top of the page? He said, there's a stamp that says top secret. And I said to him, what is on the bottom of the page? And he looked at it, and he said, there's another stamp, top secret. And then I said, will you read what's in between these two stamps? And he read it, and he turned to the jury, and he said, it's my book. And then he explained to the jury that 30,000 copies of his book were then on the newsstands, and everybody could read it. So the point he made was that the government had wrongfully stamped these pages as though they were secrets, when in fact they were not secrets. They were to be kept from the American public.
What happened at the end?
Well, at the end, the case was dismissed just before it was sent to the jury because another very dramatic episode occurred. When the Nixon White House realized that the judge was going to order that the facts of the break-in of the psychiatrist be turned over to the lawyers, the Nixon White House extended an invitation to the judge in the middle of the trial to come to meet with the president, and that the president wanted to make him the head of the FBI. Hoover was retiring. And so they took the judge from the courtroom into the basement of the courthouse, into a limousine. They covered all the windows, and they drove the judge from the courthouse to the president's summer house in southern Florida, where he met with the president, and they made the offer. So several days later, there was a second meeting in a park overlooking the ocean at 7 o'clock in the morning. The judge met on his way to court with Mr. Halderman, who was the president's assistant. Mm-hmm. And he told them that he did not want to accept the position. But the news found out about it. And it was revealed, and it was spectacular, that the President of the United States, in an effort to influence a judge, met privately with the judge and offered him a high position. Because of that revelation, the case was dismissed. I defended Amy Carter, who was the daughter of President Jimmy Carter, in the 80s. She was a student, and she and 40 other students at the University of Massachusetts seized a building and held the building and refused to give up the building. And so she was arrested with the other 40. This was a protest against the Contra War in Nicaragua. Actually, the CIA was coming to that building to interview students who they wanted to select for CIA employment. The students, in a protest against the war, seized and held the buildings so that the interviews could not take place. She was charged with the crime of trespassing, of entering a building illegally and holding it. And we went to trial. And our defense was that in the charter of the university, a criminal organization is not permitted to come to the school for purposes of recruiting students. So we had to prove in the case that the CIA was a criminal organization. That was our defense. And in the trial, we called Ramsey Clark, who testified about the World Court opinion on the CIA mining of a harbor in Nicaragua. We called Daniel Ellsberg, who testified about the criminal mind.
Ellsberg, the one you mentioned during the Pentagon paper.
That's right. This was after the Pentagon Papers trial. And he testified about the criminality that was the mental state in the CIA. We called Howard Zinn, who testified about historically young Americans would fight against their own government when it abused authority and when it stood for injustice. He talked about not just the war for independence from colonial Britain, he talked about slavery and the fight to free the slaves, and he talked about the fight for labor rights and the fight for gender equality. And he brought the history right down to that time. And when the trial was over, it was tried to a jury of 12 people from the farming region in Massachusetts, all rural people. They acquitted Amy Carter and her co-defendants on their only defense, which was the CIA is a criminal organization and had no right to come to the school. It was a great victory. It's an honor and a privilege. And it has always been this way for me, to stand with people who have devoted their lives and made a much stronger commitment to justice, to truth, to peace. Lawyers are very privileged. We involve ourselves in a case, and our life goes on, but the people we represent, like the Cuban Five, are held in very difficult circumstances. And so to stand with them, to express their passion and their commitment to justice and peace is a privilege. I I feel very honored by this, and it is, I feel I'm a very lucky man. And I hope that I will someday be able to be with them on the day when they walk out of prison.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky.
Of writers for the 99% have created a wonderful new book for Haymarket Press to chronicle the daily details of Occupy Wall Street life in the square. A team of nearly 60 writers with rotating membership collaborated on the details of this movement, such as running the General Assembly, how the Security and Medical Center operates, and then telling the stories of those involved. We're joined today by Orr Books publisher Colin Robinson. He's written for the New York Times and the London Guardian. He's worked for a number of major publishing houses before launching his own. And he joins us today to talk more about the book and what inspired him to pull it all together. Colin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be here.
Colin, this is a beautiful book, Occupying Wall Street, the inside story of an action that changed America. It's beautifully written. I used to go over there every day, so did Michael. And you read this book and you kind of re-feel how it meant to go over to that fantastic action. How did this book come about? How did you generate this book? It's really a unique thing.
Well, at Orr Books, we'd published a book called Tweets from Tahrir, which was a collection of Twitter feeds from Tahrir Square, which did very well and got widely praised. And so when Occupy started, obviously, we were supportive of what was going on down in Zuccotti. And I thought, well, we should do a book about this too. So beginning of October, I went down to the trash cans outside my apartment and pulled an old Budweiser carton out of the trash and cut it into the shape of a book cover and wrote on it with a Sharpie, Occupying Wall Street by Writers for the 99%. And I photographed it on my iPhone on the table at home and sent it out with a press release. And New York Magazine picked it up and ran a story saying, Occupy Wall Street has a book. And it then went everywhere. It went to the LA Times, the Washington Post, CNN, and there was a huge story about Occupying Wall Street having a book. So we were off and running, and the journalists were calling me up and saying, who are the writers for the 99%?
Who are they?
Well, it says, the book says at the bottom, writers for the 99%.
Right. Well, at that point, there were no writers for the 99%, so I was saying to the journalists, I'm not in a position at this point to reveal their names, which was not untrue. But then I had to get volunteers. So we went down to Zuccotti and we talked to some of the facilitators down there who were running the General Assemblies, and they said, you should just come to a General Assembly, we'll put it on the agenda, and you can tell the General Assembly about the book and get some volunteers and you'll be fine. So we went down there one, I think it was a Wednesday night in early October. I was not feeling very comfortable about this because, first of all, I had to speak through the people's microphone, which I'd never done before. And it's a particular skill. I mean, you have to be able to speak very concisely. And I mean, there were a lot of people down there who were very good at it, but I wasn't confident that I was going to be any good at it. And secondly, what I wanted to say was actually quite complicated, because I wanted to say that this was a book that didn't claim to be the official book of Occupy Wall Street. It wasn't analytical, because it was too early to make an analysis. It was descriptive, that all of the proceeds from the book were going to Occupy Wall Street, and that we were looking for volunteers, but to get all of that information out through the people's microphone to a general assembly seemed like a challenge.
Let me interrupt for a second, Colin. I want to tell our listeners again, we're talking to Colin Robinson, the editor of Occupying Wall Street, or publisher, with OR Books, The Inside Story of an Action That Changed America, written by the writers for the 99%. Colin's describing how he got the book written, or how it was written. I just want to put in a plug here. It's a fabulous book. It has chapters such as The Beginnings, which really give you the origin from the beginning of Tunisia and before, when the Occupy movement had its real origins, all the way through Egypt and then into Wisconsin and here, and then goes through chapter 60 Wall, Brooklyn Bridge, including A Day in the Life, and has an opening illustration that I just love, because the opening illustration is actually a map of Zuccotti Park occupied, and with all the places that any of you who went down there should be familiar with, the sacred space, the kitchen, etc. Anyway, we're talking to Colin. Go ahead, Colin, is how you got it written.
So I was a little nervous about speaking at this General Assembly to try and get permission to publish the book, but I comforted myself with the thought that actually it was quite a small General Assembly that night. There were probably only 150 people sitting below the steps by the big red thing at the end of the square.
You mean the big sculpture by De Souvero?
Right, exactly.
That's what the big red thing. The most famous sculptor in America, perhaps.
Well, I'm sharing my Philistinism here, but
Friends with his brother, who was a radical lawyer, who's still around, Hank De Souvero, who lives in Australia. But
I think most people in the square called it the big red thing. So there were about 150 people sitting on the paving in front of the statue, and I thought, well, maybe that'll make it a little easier. But just as the item about the book was due to come up, Michael Moore, who was speaking on the other side of the square, finished speaking, and about 2,000 people turned around and came and sat in the General Assembly. So it was then a vast crowd. And my daughter, who was with me sitting next to me on the steps, leaned over to me and said, "You are so screwed." But anyway, what happened was that the General Assembly then slowed down to such an incredibly laborious pace that they never got to the item about Occupying Wall Street, the book. And the facilitator said, "Well, actually, what you should do is forget about taking it to the General Assembly. Go to a Education and Empowerment Committee meeting in 60 Wall Street and take it up there and ask for volunteers there." The following week, we went along to an Education and Empowerment Committee meeting, working group meeting. I think there were about 60, 70 people in the group. There were three of us. One person introduced the book. And the response, I have to say, at that point was really not very encouraging. People were suspicious of who we were, whether this book was going to be seen as the official book of Occupy Wall Street, which we were saying it wasn't, but they thought that it would be, and whether it was going to be developing an analysis that they didn't agree with. And we were saying, no, it's going to be descriptive, it's not analytical, and exactly where the money was going from the book, they wanted to know about that. And there was a lot of the twinkling was either, you know, out flat, or some of it was down. And in the end, some guy basically stood up at the back and said, you know, I don't think we should support this. And we got blocked. You know, he crossed his arms in front of his chest and said, no, if this goes through, I'm walking out.
So they blocked it.
They blocked it.
And what's interesting, just to push into the book a little bit, there is a chapter that talks about the General Assembly, and particularly talks about, for those of the listeners who don't know, all the different hand signals, right, what the hand signal is for a block, what it is for agreement, etc.
Well, blocking is a very serious thing. I mean, you only use blocking if you are really passionately opposed to something. And if you're basically saying, I don't want to be any part of this movement if this goes through. And it happened to us. And I can tell you, it was very unpleasant. We felt really wounded by it. So we kind of walked away from that meeting thinking, you know, maybe we can't do this book. But what immediately happened was that a number of people from the Education and Empowerment Group came up to us and said, you know what, we feel really badly about the way you've just been treated. We'll volunteer to help. And so we thought, okay, well, let's go ahead and see whether we can do it anyway. So we started meeting weekly, sometimes twice a week, in 60 Wall Street. And the meetings got bigger and bigger. And some of the meetings were 30, 40 people were coming along to discuss how to put the book together. So what we did was we came up with a structure, chapter by chapter. There are two themes through the book. One is a chronological account of the action. So the day the occupation started on September 17th, pepper spraying and the march over Brooklyn Bridge where there were the mass arrests, the day of action with the unions, the attempt to close the occupation by Bloomberg that was repelled on October 15th. And then, of course, the successful ending, successful from the point of view of Bloomberg and the city, of ending of the occupation on November 17th. That's one strand through the book. And the other strand through the book is a kind of drilling down into the daily detail of what life was like in the square. So we've got sections in the book on how the kitchen worked, how the library worked, how the General Assembly worked, what was going on around the periphery of the square, the meditation center, every aspect of what was going on. There's a chapter in the book on culture in the square.
About the art, the media. I mean, it brings
really
the whole
exciting
thing alive. And the cover is exactly what you photograph with your iPhone, brown cardboard, and then written in a Sharpie, Occupying Wall Street, the inside story of an action that changed America. And then it says, it doesn't list a writer. It just says, writers for the 99%. And you read the book, and of the 18, 20 chapters or so, there's no writer of any one of the chapters. You have to get to the last part of the book who describes writers for the 99%. It's the last page that just lists a bunch of writers. So this is really a collective effort.
Yes, I mean, I thought at first what I would do would be to interview the people who were volunteering to write, pick the ones who could write well, and you know, as kindly as possible, tell the ones who didn't write so well that they couldn't be part of it. But I soon realized that was not in the spirit of Occupy Wall Street. We were trying to produce the book in a way which reflected the values of Occupy Wall Street. That meant that it was produced in a very democratic, horizontal fashion. Anyone who wanted to participate could. And I couldn't sit there in judgment who I thought could write and who couldn't. So basically, anyone who wanted to write was in.
But I understand, did people submit writing to you, or was it all done in this 60 Wall Street meeting where people took notes on what was said?
So we came up with a chapter structure. We sent people out into the square, and we did about 200 interviews in the square with different people. And then we brought them back. We allocated the interviews to each chapter, and we tried to find three or four people to write each chapter. And we were trying to make sure that within each group of writers, there was at least one person who we thought was a strong writer. The wonderful thing about the book was that what became clear when the chapters came in a couple of weeks later, the whole book was written by 60 people in 2 weeks.
Really?
I practically passed out with surprise because the chapters came in all on time. And if you're a publisher, you know how unusual that is. I mean, that never happens. They all came in on time. And when we started reading them through, we realized these are great. I mean, these are really well written. And what had happened was that the good writers had brought the less good writers up to their standard. And I think the reason that that happened was because this book absorbed the ethos of Occupy Wall Street. I think the lack of ego in the book.
You feel it when you read it.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's palpable, Colin.
It's such a pleasure to read and so inspiring. I mean, it's remarkable.
Colin, before we get into more of the story about the book, tell people where they can get it.
We published it through All Books. We published it December 17th was when we first got copies of it. And we sold it off our site, which is what we do at All Books, direct to readers for a couple of months and got a lot of coverage for it. We got a buzz going around the book. It's been in The New Yorker. It's been in The Guardian. All over the place, really. But now it is available from Haymarket Books. They put it out into the bookstores. We did a deal with them, have fraternal relations with Haymarket. It's a great publisher. They put it out into the bookstores, and they're selling it on Amazon. So you can buy it on front tables at Barnes & Noble now. Barnes & Noble are running a promotion for it, and it should be there right at the front of the store.
It's called Occupying Wall Street, and it's written by writers for the 99%. But Colin, talk to me about the artwork in the book. It's beautiful artwork for
it's
every
pen
chapter.
And ink. It really makes you feel like you're there also.
Well, again, it was so almost magical the way it came together. I was thinking, you know, we should put some photographs in the book. And then towards the end of the process, one of the people in the group said, you know, I know some artists who've been painting in the square, you know, just doing these sketches in the square. Maybe we could have a look at their stuff. So we asked them if they would send their illustrations over. They were great. They're so spontaneous. I think they really capture the mood of Occupy, the creative mood of Occupy, better than photographs could possibly have done. So there's a photo, there's an illustration for each chapter by a group of artists who were active in the occupation.
Colin, it's really hard to select one particular part of this book because it really is poetically written. But I was blown away by the General Assembly chapter. May you read something for us from that chapter?
Sure. So this is the General Assembly is the name of the chapter. And it starts, the General Assembly, an extraordinary nightly display of consensual democracy in action, soon became one of the defining experiences of Occupy Wall Street. No one attending its meetings, generally held at 7 p.m. each evening in the shadow of the big red statue at the east end of Zuccotti, could fail to be impressed, indeed often moved, by the spirit of community engendered by the GA, as it came to be known. Participants, on some evenings numbering in the thousands, sat on the steps running down from Broadway or huddled together at their foot on the paving of the park. Behind them, activists gathered in serried rows, some on the low walls of the flower planters, others stretching off into the copse of small trees that forms a parasol over the interior of the park. The meeting was addressed from the steps, with speakers distinguished only by the fact that they were on their feet, surrounded by the GA's facilitators, bellowing their words in the steady rhythmic cadence that the people's mic demands. The diversity of the crowd was immediately apparent. Those sleeping in the park, with the grimy demeanour and clothing that signalled the rigours of camping out, stood next to smartly attired office workers, who had apparently dropped by on a detour from their evening commute. Older activists, dressed as if they had just returned from hearing Country Joe play Woodstock, sat crammed next to college students who dressed, well, pretty much the same way. What unified this disparate throng was a tangible sense of solidarity, a commitment to the cause of the occupation, but also an evident commitment to each other. It was not unusual for food, packets of cookies or pretzels, or bottles of water to be passed hand to hand around the rows, shared by strangers who had just become comrades. The crowd was united also by a gentle but firm resolve to respect the rights of others, to space, to be heard, to be whoever they were.
That's great. It's really moving. It's really like you're still there. And, of course, it makes you miss it tremendously. I mean, when you read this book, you realize what we had for at least a few shining months in New York City and the rest of the country.
Yeah, but I think what gives me hope was that I was down there a lot, obviously, and it was like a shot in the arm every time I would go down there and I would come back just feeling that the world was a much better place. But, I went down there with my godchildren. They're young, they're barely, in double digits. And I could see that they were being radicalized by this. I mean, they were drawn in by it. And there were a lot of young people who went down there, older people too, who were radicalized by that experience. And, that doesn't go away quickly. Those people are still going to be committed to this cause. And that gives me hope that...
I don't think it ever goes away, Colin.
It's going to continue.
I had that feeling in the huge anti-war demonstrations in the 1960s, and you always live to repeat that. And when I'd go down there, and Michael would go down there, and we went down there a lot, you got the feeling back, because you had a feeling of hope and solidarity, and that cut across all these arguments about the selfishness of human nature. You know, people were coming together to try to make things better. They won't forget that. And I think that your book, Occupying Wall Street, Writers for the 99%, will perpetuate that.
I think the other thing that I noticed when I was down there was that, although they denied it vigorously at all times, there was a very impressive leadership working down there. There was a group of young people who were really smart and really charismatic and very effective. And I'm not quite sure what they're up to at this point, but I'm sure they haven't gone away either. And I'm very confident that they're going to be coming up with ways of keeping Occupy going through the spring of 2012.
Well, we know we saw the effort to reoccupy Zuccotti last week. And, of course, with the police brutality and clearing it again. When you worked on this book, was there anything that really surprised you that you didn't really, I mean, there's probably a lot you didn't know before, but anything striking about the process, the setup?
I think, I mean, what surprised me was how beautifully and easily it came together. I mean, normally putting a book together, well, I mean, you guys know, and we published one with you. It's a struggle, you know. You have to, you know, really work at it. People did put in work on this, but it seemed to be effortless. And I think it was because the ethos of Occupy was absorbed by the people who were working on the book. So if ever there was any kind of clash of egos in the group, people just backed down. That was very evident. You know, they worked in an incredibly concentrated and effective way together. It was completely collective.
The other thing that strikes me about the book is how politically acute it is. The Occupy people, as personified by the collective that wrote this book, really have their heads screwed on straight. So they knew who the enemy was. And they know how the enemy is going to continue to be. For example, in one of the chapters, they talk about how the occupying sites in 18 different cities around the country were closed down all on the same night with the same tactics and all coordinated by Homeland Security, you know, right out of Washington. That's what I mean by they know what they're up against. And that's why I share with you an optimism that they're going to be able to figure out what to do next this spring and summer.
Why it's going to be very difficult to crush this movement is because it is so open and democratic and participatory. If you repress a little bit of it, it'll just spring up somewhere else. And that's what's going to happen. I mean, I'm sure they want to try and stop it from reoccupying spaces in New York City. And I'm really confident that they're not going to be able to. You know, they're going to have to think of new tactics in the face of the toughness from the police. But I'm very confident, having seen that leadership at work in those 2 months in the fall of last year, that they're going to be able to do that.
I notice on the book that there's going to be royalties to people. Where do the royalties go for this book?
All of the proceeds from the book are going to Occupy Wall Street. We were really clear from that from the get-go. And I think the book's been doing pretty well. Not only have we sold quite a few copies through All Books and now got it out from Haymarket in the bookstores and on Amazon, but also we sold foreign rights in the book. We've sold this book in a number of foreign languages. So the book is appearing in Japan, in Japanese, in Korea, in Korean, in Italian. There's an Australian edition of it coming out. Where else did we sell it? Malayalam, in the language of Kerala. The book's coming out in India.
Well, that's a communist state.
Exactly.
Well, that's good. It's a big one, though. It's more people in Kerala than the United States.
Right. They've been occupying Kerala for a long time. Right. And also, there's an audiobook version of it coming out. Audible are putting out an audiobook.
I'm sure that's going to be great, because the book is really so present when you read it that an audio version is going to be
right.
Wonderful.
So you can listen to it on the bus on the way to the next occupation.
Who's reading it on the audiobook?
I don't know yet.
Colin, here's my personal question for you, because you've just done such outstanding work in publishing. You've got a new book coming out, The Passion of Bradley Manning by Chase Madar, which is coming out any second now. You did that book for Michael Ratner and me, and you've got a spectacular track record of putting out stuff that's useful to the movement. But how did you get into this? Where does somebody like you come from to do this kind of great publishing work?
Well, you know, I was 16 in 1968. I remember in 68, I was at school in Liverpool, and we occupied our high school. And I think we had two demands. One was to be able to grow our hair, and the other was to be allowed to smoke cigarettes. I go past that school now, I see the kids coming out of there, because when I go and visit my dad up in Liverpool, and I think, you know, we won both of those struggles. They have got hair down to their shoulders, and a lot of them seem to be smoking. So you know, that was, you know, I had no idea what we were doing in that school was related to what was going on in Vietnam or Colombia or Paris or Mexico or Iran, but it was, and I got bitten by the bug of radical politics, and it's never really left me. So I got involved involved in publishing, and the natural thing for me to do seemed to be to try to publish books that reflected my interests. And that is that I don't just publish books of radical politics, but I publish a lot of those. And I think to be a radical publisher at the moment is really a great thing. I mean, I feel that moment's come back, and there are opportunities available to us as edgy political publishers that haven't been there for decades.
Thank you again for doing this book, Occupying Wall Street, the inside story of an action that changed America, written by Writers for the 99%. To our listeners, it's an incredible book.
Well, this is a book that's designed to build the movement it describes. So I hope people will go and buy the book, and I hope that they will get out and be active in the Occupy movement again in the spring of 2012, as they were in the fall of last year.
Well, it's a wonderful book. I want to get it for almost everybody I know. So, listeners, that's what you can do.
And hats off to Haymarket at haymarketbooks.org for perpetuating this book. Hats off to you, too, Colin Robinson, for your good work. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much. It was great to be here.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Thank you.